Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
And welcome to this week's episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Our guest today is Andrew Hallam. He is the millionaire teacher, but he also has a new book out. It's called The Global Expatriate's Guide to Investing. So we are going to talk to him a little bit. He has some different portfolios he talks about in this book. But today we are going to discuss the permanent portfolio and how you can use that to become a global investor. Welcome to the show, Andrew. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Miranda. Yourself?
Great. So let's get into this. So in your book, you talk about this portfolio called the permanent portfolio. So what is this portfolio and what are some of the underlying principles of the permanent portfolio?
Well, I think it was created by a guy named Harry Brown. He was an investment writer. And what he found was that people tend to get very emotional about their investments, obviously, because at times when we have bull markets, investment accounts soar. And at times when we have bear markets, investment accounts drop. And what people often end up doing is they end up doing the opposite of what they should. They often buy high and they sell low. The investment mantra really is to buy low and sell high. But we have such a tough time doing that because when the markets are soaring, usually that's coupled with good economic news. It's often coupled with headlines talking about prosperity, and people feel psychologically really good when their investments rise in value, and they think, well, they've just risen quite a bit in value. I'm going to buy more, and I'm going to get more aggressive, and I'm going to buy the rising asset class. So what Harry Brown's model is it's a portfolio broken into four parts: 25% gold, 25% U.S. stocks,
okay,
25% long-term government bonds.
Okay.
And 25% cash.
Okay. So when you're talking about these long-term government bonds, are you talking specifically about U.S. government bonds or just any government bonds? Like, you're Canadian. So, I mean, maybe you would do Canadian bonds instead.
Yeah. For an American audience, they would buy what makes it really easy, Miranda, is to buy a long-term government bond index. And so an American would buy a long-term government bond, U.S. government bond index. A Canadian would do likewise. An Australian would do likewise.
Okay. And what about if you really did want to kind of be a global investor? How would you go about doing that, especially for a U.S. audience? I mean, you're talking about U.S. stocks, you're talking about cash, you're talking about gold, and then U.S. government bonds. You know, this permanent portfolio is really heavily invested in the U.S. all of a sudden. Is there a way to kind of broaden that, you know, kind of tweak it a little bit?
Yeah, most definitely. So, okay, so you have your gold component and then you have your 25% stock component. And what people can do is they can choose to go, all right, I'm going to go with U.S. stocks, or they can split that 25% so that half of their stock allocation is U.S. stocks and half of their stock allocation would be international stocks.
Oh, okay.
So they could just, and they could do the same with bonds as well. So they could buy long-term U.S. government bonds with half of that 25%. So 12.5% of the portfolio would be U.S. government bonds, and 12.5% of the portfolio could be international government bonds. But what's really fascinating is I don't think that investors even really need to do that. There are some that argue, I'm not necessarily one of them, but there are some that argue that when you build a portfolio, there are some that suggest, like John Bogle, who actually created the firm Vanguard. He says you really don't need a foreign exposure at all in an investment account. That global markets are really so almost joined at the hip nowadays that when the United States sneezes, everybody else gets a cold. So you don't often end up having those wide disparities between an international market doing really well at times and the U.S. market isn't. They often end up going in sync more often than not. You can also see the idea that within the United States. So with the S&P 500, the stocks, if you look at those companies and you look at where their revenue actually comes from, about 30% of their revenue comes from countries or outside of the United States. Companies.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Outside the United States. So you could take Coca-Cola, for example. A relatively small amount of Coca-Cola's revenue comes from the United States.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Because if you think about it, the world buys Coca-Cola products. The world buys Pepsi products. The world buys Johnson & Johnson products. So Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Pfizer, a lot of the big pharmaceutical companies, and Apple, their products are purchased by people outside of the United States. So they're buying in euros and Australian dollars and Canadian dollars. So in a sense, these companies, they may be domiciled in the United States, but they are far more international than a lot of people think. So that's one argument to suggesting that you know, Americans may not necessarily need a large amount of international exposure because they already got it.
So, what makes this permanent portfolio, as you say, permanent? So I assume that, you know, when we talk about other types of portfolios, the asset allocation is always changing. And as you move through life, it changes. I assume with your permanent portfolio, since it's permanent, your asset allocation never changes.
Yeah, it stays the same. And here's what Harry Brown had found. He found a couple of things. One, nobody can really predict where the economy is going and where stocks are ever going to go. And if you've been watching the stock market headlines long enough, you sort of start to recognize that nobody really knows squat.
So true.
And it's often really a mystery. You get that firm CXO Advisory, and I think you and I have talked about this firm before the last time we chatted. It's a firm that actually measures forecasts, and it looks at the high-profile analysts that might be on CNBC or the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg, and they actually track where their predictions, where are the markets going to go? Where's gold going to go? Where's stocks going to go? Their success rate is worse than if you'd been flipping coins.
That's insane.
So you might as well ask your five-year-old whether you think stocks are going to go rather than listen to some economist who's going to be on CNBC. So here's the thing that Harry Brown came up with in the early 70s. He said, look, if you buy different asset classes do move in different directions. When gold rises, stocks often fall. Bonds and stocks don't always perform well at the same time. There's often this inverse correlation. So what he said was split your portfolio, 25% gold, 25% stocks, 25% long-term bonds, and 25% cash. And keep it like that. So you mentioned earlier, okay, as you get older, you adjust your portfolio. A lot of people will go more into bonds and be a little bit more conservative as they get older. With the permanent portfolio, that allocation stays put. And so in a given year, here's what happens. Let's say U.S. stocks just ripped it up. We've got a 2013. U.S. stocks gained 32%. With the permanent portfolio at the end of that year, you would rebalance. You would sell off portions of your U.S. stocks. And you would buy the asset classes that haven't done as well. So you would just rebalance back to that 25, 25, 25, and 25.
Right. And you're selling. And basically what you're doing is you're selling high now in your successful asset classes. And then you're buying all the ones that lost out to rebalance it. Now you're buying low.
Yeah. And it's an automatic thing. It's a mechanical thing. It's not something that you actually have to think about. And that's what makes it successful, because when people start thinking about it and they bring their heads and their hearts into it, they mess up.
Right. That's so true, though. We never make good decisions about investing. So what about you? Is this a portfolio that you personally use in your own finances, or is it a portion of your portfolio? How do you use it in your finances?
So I don't actually use the portfolio at all, the permanent portfolio. What this portfolio is really, really, really good for. And again, if somebody twisted my arm and said, use it, I would have no qualms. Or if they said, you've got to use this portfolio because it's outstanding. What I wrote about in my book, The Global Expatriate's Guide to Investing, there's three different types of strategies that I felt were all equally outstanding. This was just one of those three. And so you make a choice, which is good. Instead of jumping from strategy to strategy, it's a good idea to make a choice. Now, let me tell you where this strategy or what type of personality this strategy really fits for. First of all, I don't mind volatility. I love it when stock markets crash.
Okay.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I don't mind seeing my assets rise and fall. It doesn't bother me one bit because I know that I'm not generally going to be using those assets until many years into the future.
Okay.
So I don't tend to be personally affected by the gyrations of the markets, but many people are. And what the permanent portfolio does is it stabilizes returns so that it gives decent returns over time, but it doesn't have a lot of volatility associated with it. And so if we look at returns from 1971 to 2014, returns have averaged about 9.5% per year on average.
For the permanent portfolio?
For the permanent portfolio. And that is really similar to what you're going to get with a pure stock portfolio. Now, here's where it works out beautifully for people that can get drawn by their emotions. It's only had three or four down years since 1971.
Oh, wow.
And the worst down year was in 1981, and it was a drop of just 4.1%.
That's so even not in at all.
It's outstanding. Even in 2008, when you know the markets went to hell in a handbasket, we had the permanent portfolio down less than 1% during that year. So it's quite an extraordinary level of stability. And when you have that stability, you're not going to get people necessarily jumping off bridges and doing crazy things.
Right.
When I say jumping off bridges, I'm being, you know, obviously I'm being farcical there, but the idea that metaphorically jumping off bridges with their portfolio, bailing on a strategy because it is gyrated or dropped significantly. So it's a great emotional stabilizer for people.
Awesome. So then what portfolio strategy do you personally use?
I use one that, it's a cap-weighted model. It's actually very traditional. I'm a Canadian, so what I have is a mixture of a U.S. stock market index, an international stock market index, a Canadian stock market index, and a Canadian bond market index.
Okay.
I rebalance it once a year. I have 40% allocated to bonds. So I have a short-term Canadian government bond index, and I do generally like to go with the short-term bonds. Short-term bonds typically will, I'm holding them a long time, they will outpace inflation, because if inflation rises significantly, the new bonds that will be issued will be, obviously the returns of those will be matching that, otherwise nobody would be buying them. So generally speaking, you know, you'll out-nudge inflation with short-term government bonds. And it's kind of like, a lot of people will say, well, why would you bother with bonds at all? Because they don't earn great returns. They're like my dry powder. One, they stabilize the portfolio. And two, I love it when stock markets crash. Because what do people do when markets crash? They stuff money into gold, bond, and mattresses. And that's one of the reasons why the permanent portfolio itself really works, too, is when people are afraid of stocks, they love stuffing money into bonds and gold. So things that can help to stabilize portfolios.
Okay, that's really cool. So you're not afraid to have then like 60% of your portfolio in stocks because you have that 40% stabilizing you in bonds. So what does that kind of do for you as far as allowing you to travel the world and kind of have that income? To having those bonds, does that kind of provide you a little bit of income, or is that still your long-term portfolio?
Well, at this stage, I haven't actually touched it personally. What I could do is I could live off, there's something called the 4% rule, which is a sustainable withdrawal rate. And so what I could feasibly do is, for me, my wife and I looked at the big picture and we said, okay, can we live on 3 to 4% of our portfolio? If you can do that, you shouldn't run out of money. So if you just withdraw 3 to 4% of your portfolio and give yourself increases to cover the rising costs of living, you know, inflationary increases, your portfolio should last indefinitely. So at this stage for us, I was probably in my late 30s when I got to the point where, hey, I could actually do this. I could live off 3 to 4% of the portfolio. So we left our teaching jobs in Singapore in June, and now we travel. Yet at this stage, we haven't actually had to withdraw any money. Obviously, I've written a couple of books, so there's
well,
and I continue to write. So we're at this stage spending a lot less than we're actually earning as we're traveling. So
nice. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show today and telling us a little bit about the permanent portfolio. Real quick, can you tell the audience where they can find you?
Well, they can find me at my website, andrewhallam.com. And both of my books are available on Amazon. So it's Millionaire Teacher and The Global Expatriate's Guide to Investing. The Millionaire Teacher was written more for purely for an American Canadian audience. And then the second book is one that really spans internationally. So it works for domestic U.S. citizens living in the United States and then globally as well.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll go ahead and move into the roundtable portion of the show. Welcome to this week's episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. We have been talking to Andrew Hallam of The Millionaire Teacher, and we've been talking about the permanent portfolio and how you can use that to sort of create a portfolio that takes you through the ups and downs. So now we're going to move into the panelist portion of our show, where we have Joe Saul Sehi of StackingBenjamins.com, Andrew Sather of eInvestingForBeginners.com, and me, I'm Miranda, and I am from PlantingMoneySeeds.com. So let's go ahead and get started. What do you guys think of this permanent portfolio? What are its strengths and weaknesses?
All right, I'll just jump in. Definitely some great strengths there, especially because of the gold component. I mean, talk about 25% gold. And if you look at the way that governments have been run as of late, and you have all these governments printing their way just into oblivion. Just it's like everybody's in a competition to see who can outprint the other country. And so for sure you see gold over 2,100, you know, and then it's kind of come back a little bit. But as it's come back, stocks really raged forward. So you get this really nice synergy and balance of when markets come down, gold usually rises, and you get, like you said, very little years of drawdowns and a nice cushion of volatility. So that's definitely a strength. I would say a weakness is it's very conservative. So being 25% cash and 25% gold, if you guys know the way that I like to invest for cash flow. And so by having 50% of a portfolio not in cash flow producing assets, then you're really missing out on a lot of growth in the future and a lot of compounding as well. So those are some strengths and weaknesses. I think a lot of people can really use it to their advantage, and especially with the way that governments are, you know, doing their thing now. But at the same time, there are some drawbacks and maybe some better ways of doing things.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, what about you, Joe? But you're ready to go. You're in there.
Jump in. Well, because I agree with Andrew that I love the aha I think people got when they heard that portfolio, because you wouldn't think that a portfolio that has that much money in cash, bonds, and precious metals is going to have that type of a return. And I think it's this mind-blowing thing for people that a portfolio like that would almost keep up with the market over those longer time frames. The thing that I see as a weakness was a lot of the same stuff Andrew said, that you know, 25%, 25%, 25, 25 seems a little arbitrary. I think you could tweak those for your own scenario. I really, really like, you know, a little less cash, maybe expand into some other areas. We didn't talk about international stocks or things like that. So I think you can take that lesson of we can get less volatility by spreading our risk, but we can involve more asset classes than just those four.
Yeah. And I was looking at it too. And kind of like Andrew, the large cash chunk kind of made me pause. I like the idea, like he was saying, a little bit of cash flow as well as just building your wealth. And I was thinking, and I put something together for a little contest that I'm in, and I kind of use the principles of the permanent portfolio, but I've kind of tweaked it a little bit where I've got it's high yield dividend stocks and, you know, high yield bonds, they're corporate bonds, real estate and gold. So I've put in real estate in the form of REITs that pay
dividends as well. So everything except for the gold is paying some sort of interest or dividend. So I've kind of tweaked it a little bit, even though I'm keeping the 25, 25, 25, 25 asset allocation. So you did mention, Joe, too, some of the tweaks you were talking about and adding a little bit more. Personally, what kinds of things would you want to add into your portfolio? If you were building something like this, what sort of asset allocation would you want in your portfolio?
Well, for me, you know, and I feel like it's kind of a garden as a gardener. As a gardener, I like to start off with what's my goal and work backwards from there. So once I know what I'm trying to achieve, then I build a portfolio that achieves that. So if I know this portfolio historically has done 9% and I need 9% over the long term, well, then why would I take more risk than this? So then I might like the portfolio. But I think that you could peel back that precious metals 25% number to a smaller number and the huge cash portion that three of us have talked about, and add in international stocks, emerging markets, different types of bonds. I like high yield bonds over long periods of time. I think they act like this nice, Andrew talks about investing for cash flow, you know, the huge dividends that you get from some of these high yield bond funds out there are a great place to be. So that would help me, I think, still take less risk than the stock market, but perform very, very closely to would tweak the performance, I think, of this kind of arbitrary portfolio.
Okay. What do you think, Andrew? What sort of tweaks would you make if you were putting this together?
I definitely agree with Joe in the sense that definitely want to go for higher yield if you can. As far as I would definitely be more aggressive in stocks, and you guys kind of know my strategy, so I'm going to be in probably individual stocks over like an index fund and managing my own portfolio that way. So that's what I would do. And I do think it's important to have a precious metal component. Again, if you look at the, especially right now with the way gold is, it's finally seeming to like turn around and kind of come off its low. And it's interesting because with gold right now, usually you see gold move counter to the dollar. And, you know, when gold rises, the dollar is falling or vice versa. Right now, the dollar is very strong as gold is starting to pick up again. And so it's because of this money printing that's going on both in Japan and in Europe, gold's really starting to pick up again. So I think people are thinking about getting into precious metals and adding that as an asset allocation to their portfolios. I think right now is a prudent time to do that. As far as any other tweaks I would make, I agree with going for higher yield bonds, and I would probably have a stronger allocation to stocks, you know, maybe tip it to where there's more stocks than bonds or any other asset. But I would also probably avoid international stocks. And I want to see what you have to say about this, Joe. But as far as I know, a benefit to staying away from international stocks is that you stay away from the tricky tax implications. When you get a dividend from a international stock, it can, the government can put some hidden print that makes you pay more in taxes. So I would say for that reason, and as Andrew Hallam mentioned before, you can also still get exposure to the general market and the whole world by having U.S. large caps. So that's kind of my idea on that. And I'm sure you can actually go a different way as well, but that's kind of how I feel about it.
Well, I want to jump in on what Andrew's saying about gold, because the frustrating piece for me when it comes to gold is that I have a hard time knowing where gold's going. In fact, I just got an email about 5 minutes before we started recording from somebody who said, "I hate having my cash reserve sit around in cash. What if I put it all in gold?" Gold is 8 times more volatile than the stock market. And because the only utility that gold has that I know of is pretty things, right? I mean, it's not like silver or copper where it actually has some industrial utility. I have such a difficult time with gold versus other metals having any type of prediction on where it's headed. Man, gold frustrates me. So that's why for me, a 25% allocation in gold is really, really difficult. I've got 25% of my portfolio locked into something that is very unpredictable. And you look at the 90s as an example, gold did nothing for 9-10 years? I mean, gold did absolutely nothing. And then, man, it went through the roof. And now we're back on the streak again where it's done nothing for a number of years. And who knows when it's going to end.
So that's kind of a good point. And one of the things I did want to go back on what Andrew mentioned, you know, as far as this gold issue goes, he mentioned money printing in Europe and Japan. And so what I'm wondering is, do you think as you're building your portfolio, do you think you need to pay attention to like the global market and think about how you can take advantage of that? I know Joe had mentioned exposure to international stocks. So what are some ways that you can maybe do that in your portfolio to maybe do something a little different or to pay attention to what's going on in the world? So do either of you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'll jump on that because Andrew kind of asked me that question earlier. I totally agree that when you get into international positions, now you've got this tax wonkiness. But on top of that, you also have currency plays, right? Where an international stock might be a great idea today versus the U.S. You know, the company might be booming, might not be booming, but because of the way the currency fluctuation is, we might see it or we might not if we're in the U.S. versus Thailand, let's say. But still, I look at areas of the world, especially emerging markets, and maybe I'm just attracted to the sexiness, Miranda.
Well, you know, you do like sexy.
Maybe that's it. But when I look at these economies in India and Singapore and, you know, just Southeast Asia in general, I get really excited. Brazil, I get so excited about some of these international economies and the growth that we see there that I look at those as places for the future. I know historically, by the way, it hasn't panned out. So from that perspective, I'm with Andrew. U.S. stocks historically have way outperformed the promise of international, but I'm not going to give up the dream. Maybe I'm waiting for Santa Claus. I don't know.
So, but do you think that as you're building your portfolio, you do need to pay attention to what's going on in the rest of the world? A lot of us think, oh, well, what's going on with the U.S. economy and how are things going here? But do we need to start paying attention to what's going on in Europe, what's going on in Japan and the rest of Asia? And really, some people are starting to say, well, we need to start looking at, you know, up and coming, you know, markets in South America as well. I mean, do we need to pay attention to these things?
I mean, Kentucky Fried Chicken is in China. So we, you know, and Kentucky Fried Chicken, what is that? Yum Brands is a U.S. firm. So if we're buying U.S. stocks, we're buying that. But if China doesn't perform, then Yum Brands won't perform. So I think we definitely have to look at the world as a single economy or look at the different economies around the world.
What do you think, Andrew?
In a sense, you do have to pay attention to what's going on, but I don't think it should affect your investing decisions. So it sounds kind of counterintuitive since I kind of went on my rant about gold. But I think there's only so much you can control, and trying to figure out everything that might happen in the future is just going to drive you crazy. So, you know, you just got to find a smart asset allocation and just kind of stick to it. I think going to Joe's point, there's a lot of potential in some of these third world countries. If you look at the growth we've seen in India, India is now second most, they've produced the most coal firing plants, I believe, and their economy is going through an industrial revolution similar to what we went through 50, 100 years ago, and same with China as well. And so if you look at India that way, and then you look at a country like the Philippines is where India was 10 years ago. I'm half Filipino, so I'm really aware to everything that's going on there. It's very interesting because with India, you would call customer service and usually you get routed to somebody in India. Nowadays, you hear somebody and they have a Filipino accent, and a lot of these customer service departments are now in the Philippines. And so with the way that India's boomed, it could be very likely that the Philippines will boom and follow suit as well. So definitely there's a lot of opportunity in the emerging markets. As far as, you know, what I would do with my own portfolio is, you know, just like we've been pounding the table on, just get those asset allocations right and really be exposed to the things that you understand most. So for me, that's individual stocks. So I'm going to tilt my exposure more to individual stocks. And for other people who might have a more global perspective and have more information on, you know, which markets might be booming or emerging, then I think you should put more focus on that.
I think this is a good place to stop. We've covered some pretty good ground about the permanent portfolio and different options for tweaking it or figuring out what you want and seeing if it'll work for you. Once again, if you have more questions about investing, visit our website at moneytreepodcast.com. You can also subscribe on iTunes, and we'll deliver a fresh episode to you every week. And of course, you can check with our individual websites where we have plenty of information on investing and personal finance and how to make the most of your money.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.